Only the bulb was flickering and there were so many mosquitoes that I felt more like a snack than a scholar. I kept at it, though, swatting and muttering and watching a steady trickle of automobiles roll by. Some stayed close up and quiet as they passed. Others were so full there were passengers standing on the running boards. Those were the rowdy ones, with men whooping and carrying on loud enough so I could make out each and every word they said. "Gonna put 'em in their place tonight," one man hollered. And a few minutes later, "Sheriff better turn that boy over if he knows what's good for him." Even without the mosquitoes, those voices would have been enough to make reading old Mr. Shakespeare near impossible. Yet I sat there pretending to try, wondering what was afoot at the courthouse, until maybe half an hour had passed, and one of those sets of headlamps coming down the street turned into our driveway so fast the tires squealed. It was Pop in the Model T, him and the iron in his eyes. He wasted no time on greetings as he strode past, saying I should follow him inside. And when he led me to the parlor where Mama was waiting, her gaze fell on me first, calmer than it had any right to be. Pop asked straight off if Angelina was in her quarters. Mama replied yes. Then Pop said I should go out and tell her to lock her door and stay put for the night. I looked to Mama, who nodded and said she'd have no further need of Angelina anyway. So I hustled back, and Angelina cracked open the door before I'd even knocked, just wide enough for me to hear sniffling behind her. It was Freddy, I suppose, still worrying over his dog. Then I delivered Pop's message to Angelina, adding, "He doesn't know your kin are here." And the whites of Angelina's eyes shone scared against the dark as she whispered, "I can hear them, Mr. Will. Even through the window glass, I can hear those men driving by, calling for that poor boy's blood." There was nothing I could say. Leastways, nothing that would make her feel better. But it didn't matter, for Pop's voice boomed across the yard, telling me to come back inside. And Angelina shut the door so quick I near lost a finger. I crossed the lawn at a jog, shaking my hand and gritting my teeth from the pain. But I forgot all about it as soon as the porch light came on and Pop stepped outside with the long barrel of his Remington resting against his shoulder. "Fetch your Springfield," he barked. "Now!" Which loosed the invisible strings holding me back and set me hustling inside to get my hunting shotgun from Pop's gun rack. Back in the parlor, Mama sat, white-lipped, watching Pop slide around into the Remington's chamber. "Load it," he told me, pointing to a box of shells. Mama's expression went far away, distant, and the color drained from her cheeks altogether. When I hesitated, feeling suffocated by all the things I didn't know about or understand, Pop picked up the box of shells and rattled it in front of my nose. "You deaf," he snapped. I said I wasn't, and cracked open the Springfield's barrel, thankful Pop was too busy filling his ammunition belt to notice the shake in my hands. "Hurry up," he said. "We got work to do." And I did as I was told because he was my father, and because it hadn't yet occurred to me that I had any other choice.
Rowan. The rest of the day that Arvin died was a blur of uniforms, ambulances, and sirens. I spent a long time at the hospital, 5 hours, maybe 6. One CT scan, lots of different people asking me to rate things on a scale from 1 to 7, 7 being the worst. How much did my head hurt? 7. How nauseated was I? 3. How hard was it to concentrate? 8. Nobody asked how it had felt seeing the Suburban hit Arvin, or hearing his bones shatter. I guess there wasn't any scale for that. I cried a lot, too. Post-concussion symptom, the neurologist said. Bullshit. After the hospital, Mom gave me enough painkillers to muffle the bad thoughts and set them adrift. She curled up next to me in her pajamas, and when I woke in the middle of the night, sobbing, she gave me 2 more pills, kissed my forehead, and feathered her fingertips against my back until the drugs kicked in and I fell back to sleep. The next day, the police came. Detective Bennett was a youngish black woman dressed in a pantsuit that pulled tight across her hips. Her partner, Detective Bland, looked like a mall Santa shaved clean for the off-season. I was propped up on the leather sofa in Dad's darkened study, with an ice pack on my neck and a blanket pulled up to my chest. Mom had pushed the coffee table back and moved two armchairs close to me. She stayed at the foot of the couch, resting her hand on my ankle. Dad leaned against the bookshelves by the door. Detective Bennett had me describe the accident. After that, she asked what the other driver had done when he got out of his truck. I didn't want to talk about it. Didn't know if I could. Dad asked the detectives if he could speak with them in the other room. When they came back, Detective Bennett apologized for having to interview me when I wasn't feeling well, and said she just needed me to tell her what I remembered after Mr. Brightwater showed up. I had no clue who she meant. "The indigent," she said. "Arvin Brightwater." I wanted to scream at her that he wasn't Arvin the indigent. He was Arvin the person. Mom squeezed my ankle gently. Instead of screaming, I kept my voice calm and told them Arvin had come over to the car to try and help. "He wanted to take me to see Dr. Woods," I said. "She's a doctor at the clinic where I work." I lost it a little then. Mom handed me a Kleenex and everyone waited until I could start again. "That's where I met Arvin," I said. "Dr. Woods takes care of him." Detective Bennett nodded and asked if Arvin had said anything to Mr. Randall. "Mr. Randall?" I said. "The other driver." I started to shake my head. Bright ribbons of pain reminded me to stay still. "No, Arvin was only paying attention to me." "But the man, Mr. Randall, he was so angry. He told Arvin to get away, and when Arvin wouldn't, he pushed him and..." I swiped at my tears. Detective Bennett glanced at her partner. Mom caught the look and said, "We need to wrap this up, detectives." Detective Bennett started to argue, but her partner stopped her, saying, "That's fine, Mrs. Chase. We'll come back when Rowan's feeling better. For now, I'd just like to know if there's anything else she can tell us about Mr. Brightwater's death. Anything at all." I kept my eyes on Dad as I spoke. "When he, Mr. Randall, pushed Arvin, he called him a goddamn nit." The word stuck in my throat like the last thing you feel before you throw up. "He called him the N-word." Dad didn't look away, but something shifted in his eyes, and Mom's grip tightened on my ankle. Detective Bland's lips pinched into a tight frown. He didn't believe me. Mom stood up. "I'm going to have to insist that you let my daughter rest now, detectives." Her voice was smooth and cold, a frozen plane of ice with a river of anger flowing beneath it. Detective Bland looked like he wanted to say something. Whatever it was, he kept it to himself and stood up. "Thank you, Rowan. We appreciate your help," he said. Detective Bennett looked unhappy, but she didn't argue. Dad led them to the study door. Once they were gone, Mom sat back down. "You did good," she said. "It doesn't feel that way," I whispered. "You told the truth," she handed me another tissue. "Will you drink some orange juice if I get it for you?" "I don't think I can." "You'll try." I needed to blow my nose, but knew it would hurt too much. "This is what you meant about things being complicated, isn't it?" I said. Mom nodded. I closed my eyes. The pain quieted, and I felt the air shift as she moved away. "I'll be okay," I said. Mom came back and knelt beside me. "I know you will, sweetheart," she whispered, and kissed my temple so softly it didn't even hurt. James brought me balloons and a stuffed elephant on Monday morning. At first he sat far away, like I'd break if he breathed on me too hard. I pointed at the chair closest to me and told him not to be an asshole. "Your mom wouldn't let me in yesterday. and she threatened bodily harm if I stayed too long or upset you today, he said, switching seats. She's just worried. I spent most of yesterday crying, I said. I'm not surprised. How are you? Today? Mad. Really mad. A man I should have treated better is dead, and I'm not sure whether it's because he was black or because he was poor or because some people are just plain evil. And you know what? I'm starting to think no one's going to do anything about it. Arvin's probably going to end up just another murdered black man whose killer gets to walk. They may as well dump his body at a construction site and forget about it. James seemed surprised at first. Then he leaned closer with this really intense look on his face. So what are you going to do about it? About Arvin? I said. There's nothing I can do except hope the DA will press charges. But that still leaves another dead black man who deserves better than he got. I want to figure out who the skeleton was. For real, James. And I want to know who killed him. I'm in, James said. Where do we start? With minor fraud. He was appropriately concerned. Relax. All I need you to do is go to the title company, pretend to be me, and pick up the title to our house. It's what I was on my way to do Saturday morning. That seems a tiny bit illegal, he said. It probably is, but no one there knows I'm not a guy. Rowan goes both ways. James gave me his wickedest smile. Quit talking dirty, Chase. You know I'm not interested. It was the first time anyone had treated me normally since Saturday, and I had to roll my eyes to keep from bawling. It hurt so bad I nearly cried anyway. I need you to do this for me, I said. Even if I could drive myself, that asshat nearly totaled my car. James was quiet. I think he was only pretending to think it over, but my skin was too thin to deal with teasing just then. Please, I said. If I hadn't been on my way to get the title, there never would have been an accident in the first place. James tried to say something. I cut him off. The police buried the skeleton's file at the bottom of their cold case stack, and the only real investigator trying to figure out who he was can barely carry on a conversation with the living. If we leave this thing unsolved, Arvin will have died for nothing. James was quiet. I could hear Dad and Mom talking in the kitchen. Not actual words, just their voices rising and falling. If I get arrested for impersonating you, your mom had better go all pro bono on my ass, James said. Don't be stupid. If you get arrested, Dad will make a phone call and fix it. James stood up. Okay, I'll give it a try. But if they ask me for ID or act suspicious, I'm out of there. Deal. You know you're the only person in the world I'd do this for, he said. Because you love me, right? He tilted his head, serious and soft all at once. Yes, Chase, because I love you. At first, I thought Mom was just checking on me when she peeked in later that morning. But when she saw I was awake, she told me I had a visitor and opened the door wide for True. It was a pleasure meeting you, Truman, Mom said. True gave her his full-on smile. Yes, ma'am. And don't worry, I won't stay long. My nephew's a wide receiver at Booker T and took a late hit last season that knocked him out cold. I know all about concussion protocols. Mom tilted her head and gave him her "you interest me" look before she left. People don't surprise her very often. Not in a good way, at least. I think she kind of likes it when they do. Then she ducked out, and True put a clean mayonnaise jar full of black-eyed Susans on the table next to me and said the best thing he could have. Rowan, I am so, so sorry. I burst into tears. He sat down and waited quietly until I was done. At the exact right moment, he started talking again. Mama Ray sent the flowers, and I came to tell you in person that you shouldn't come back to work until you're ready. But if you're up to it, Arvin's funeral is Thursday at 6, and all of us from the clinic are going. He offered me a tissue and took one for himself. If you can make it, he said, it'll be your big chance to see Janice from Billing. We're having a reception at my house afterwards. She's bringing the Diet Coke. I laughed, ignoring the pain it sent shooting through my head. I'll be there, I said. And True? I'm sorry I didn't call in sick. He looked at me like I was nuts. Are you kidding me? Besides, your mom called Dr. Woods to tell her what happened. Did you know they went to high school together? Only since Friday. Well, he said, even as we speak, a completely overwhelmed lady from the temp agency is at the reception desk trying to deal with Mrs. Penfield. That woman shows up like clockwork every Monday with some fatal disease she read about online. Someone really does need to cut off her internet. I laughed again. It still hurt, and it still felt good. Thank your mother for me, please, I said. For the flowers, I mean. True winked and grinned. Mama Ray's gonna like you, he said. And suddenly I understood why he never kept his meth-wrecked smile hidden. It showed where he'd been, what he'd gone through. It was proof he'd chosen to survive. I ditched the prescription painkillers Tuesday morning and switched to ibuprofen so the sharp edges of my grief could come into focus. It was awful. So was the headache that started up as soon as I opened my laptop. But I was sick of lying still, trying not to feel things all the way. If the neurologist could have seen what I was doing, he would not have been pleased. I started with the Victory Victrola shop listing in the 1921 Polk directory, then backtracked, 1920, 1919, etc., until the listing disappeared in 1916. That meant the shop had opened in either late 1916 or early 1917. After that, I worked forward. In 1929, there was a Victory Radio Shop listed instead of the Victory Victrola Shop. The address was the same, though, and the proprietor was still Stanley Tillman. His home address never changed in all those years, and he stayed married to Catherine. But there was no William E. Tillman, student, listed under Stanley's entry past 1921, or anywhere else in the directory for that matter. And in 1937, Stanley Tillman and the Victory Radio Shop disappeared from it altogether. After I'd poked around for an hour, it felt like a roller derby was going on inside my head. I set my phone alarm for 30 minutes, closed my eyes to rest, and made it a full 15 before I got impatient and turned the alarm off. That's when I started digging around the Tillman family tree, found a historical newspaper database, forked over $19.95, and read the obituary. Mr. Stanley George Tillman of Tulsa suffered a fatal heart attack the morning of Friday, September 3rd, 1937, in the Victory Radio Shop on Main Street that he had run successfully for 20 years. Mr. Tillman moved to Indian Territory from Cuyahoga County, Ohio, in 1899, and married Catherine Elizabeth Yellowhorse in 1902. He is survived by his widow, who resides in Pawhuska. The whereabouts and disposition of his son, William Edward Tillman, are unknown. That made for an awful lot of question marks around William Tillman, including why his initials were all over the Victrola receipt from the dead man's pocket. Payments rendered by Jay Goodhope towards one Victor Talking Machine Company, Victrola Model 14. Jay Goodhope. I pulled up the 1921 directory, scrolled to the G's, and found one entry. Goodhope. Della. Parentheses Wid Theodore. Cook. Nut and Honey Cafe. Greenwood Avenue. R114 Jasper Street. It was close, but that was D. Goodhope, not J. I tried to find 114 Jasper anyway, just to see where Della had lived, only there was no such address in Tulsa anymore. I did find a historian's map outlining the boundaries of the area affected by the race riot, though, and there, inside the shaded zone where everything had burned, was a little stretch of Jasper Street. Which meant Della Goodhope's house had probably been destroyed in the riot, but since her husband's name had been Theodore, and since there was no other Goodhope listed, I let that particular thread drop. Besides, any woman living and working in Greenwood had to have been black, and I remembered enough from Oklahoma history to know that Jim Crow laws would have kept black people out of a Main Street Victrola shop anyway, so Jay Goodhope must have been white. Still, I liked the name Nut and Honey Cafe, and that got me wondering about what Greenwood must have been like before the riot. I found pages with stories from survivors, descriptions of what happened, photos of smoke pouring out of the Mount Zion Baptist Church roof, and of black men walking down Greenwood as white men held guns to their backs. I also found statements from white Tulsans denying there had been anything more than a few scuffles that night. But when I stumbled onto digital copies of a black-owned newspaper called the Tulsa Star, I felt like I was really getting a glimpse of what life in Greenwood had been like before the riot. There were stories about how bad race relations were, not just in Tulsa, but all around the country. I found an editorial that argued toy companies should make brown-skin dolls, and a bunch of others calling on black people to stop settling for second best. The writers questioned the way things were and talked about how much better they could be. And there were advertisements that painted a picture of life in Greenwood. Luxury rooms at the Red Wing Hotel, top-notch service at the Alexander Laundry, laughter and tears on screen at the Dreamland Theater. There was even an ad for radium water treatments at the Washington Bathhouse, which couldn't have ended well for anyone. And then, on the last page of a December edition from 1921, I found an ad for the Nut and Honey.
When you ask what's for dinner and she says, "Nothing, honey," take her to the Nut and Honey Cafe. Finest in home-style cooking. You must try our pies.
And that was all my bruised brain could take. So I closed my laptop, shut my eyes, and dreamed of pie.
William, you can think yourself into all kinds of trouble when you're alone in the dark, especially when there are mice in the walls and creaky wood floors and a gun on your shoulder, plus your own heart thumping so loud in your ears that it near drowns out the rest. Springfield was loaded, and I had 2 full boxes of extra shells thanks to Pop. Any other day, I'd have been tickled pink if both he and Mama had sent me off driving on the very same night. But sitting there in the shop under Pop's strict orders to shoot anyone who tried to come through the door, I was anything but. Still, push come to shove, I'd have done as he said. For if there was one thing I knew, it was that you didn't carry a firearm unless you were prepared to use it. Back at the dining room table, Pop had told Mama and me how the crowd of white men around the courthouse was growing by the minute, how carloads of armed Negroes had come and gone, offering to help Sheriff McCullough keep Dick Rowland safe, and how 3 white men had gone inside the courthouse to try and drag Rowland out, only to be ejected post-haste by the sheriff's men. This whole city's a tinderbox waiting on a match, and I'll be damned if I let a bunch of hooligans ruin everything I've worked for, Pop said. It doesn't help that there's a group of white rowdies heading across 6th Street, aiming to snatch weapons from the National Guard armory. If they manage it, every fool and scoundrel east of the Arkansas will be armed and up to no good. We have to protect what's ours, William. If anyone tries to come in the shop, you shoot first and ask questions later. Understand? I nodded that I did. Mama bit down on her lip and fought back tears. And Pop glared hard at us both. Then he stood up and said for me to follow him, and told me I was to drive straight to the shop, park in the alleyway, and take up a post in front of the counter. Mama stood with us, asking why Pop didn't guard the shop himself. Pop replied that he needed to keep an eye on the situation at the courthouse. "I'm a tolerant man," he said, "and good to Negroes, but I'll not stand for armed gangs of them coming into proper Tulsa." After that, Mama kissed me and held me so long that Pop grumbled it was time to go. We drove north, him in the Model T, me in the truck behind, until Pop turned left onto 7th and I continued on. And though a few empty cars were parked along Main Street by the shop, that part of Tulsa was quiet as a ghost town. I parked in the side alley like Pop had said, and used the moonlight to find my way inside. Then I stood guard for near an hour before calling Mama, just to hear her voice and tell her I was fine. She said she was glad and that she loved me and I should be careful. After we hung up, I was alone in the quiet and the dark again, wishing I knew if Ruby was safe. Till the shot sounded. Just one, far off. Then another. Two after that. Then so many that I couldn't count. And I stood there with my gun in my hands, frozen with fear and numbed by a sudden, overwhelming awareness of just how fragile the life I knew really was. 11 minutes ticked by on the old pocket watch Pop kept near the register. I tightened my grip on the shotgun as a pair of headlamps moved north along Main Street. More gunshots sounded. Then three northbound vehicles passed by. After that, the street stayed empty. Their shots pecked and popped at the air like 4th of July fireworks. I ground my teeth so hard my jaw ached. Only so far as I could make out, the sound was moving away. And by the time 23 minutes had passed, my breathing eased and my muscles unclenched. At minute 24, the telephone rang and near scared me to death. It was Mama, checking to see how I was. I could hear the relief in her voice when I told her the gunfire was too far north to be a worry. Then she said it was good I hadn't let word slip to Pop about his surprise, and could I keep it a secret just a little while longer? Which made no sense at first, though I did have my wits about me enough to eventually figure out that Mama was speaking in code. She did that sometimes, knowing any one of the other four households sharing our telephone's party line could listen in on our conversations whenever they pleased. And whether or not we heard a click or a cough to let us know they'd picked up their receivers to spy, we always assumed they had. Mama waited patiently until I caught on that she was talking about Angelina's family. I said of course I could keep the surprise a secret, feeling guilty over how completely Grace Brightwater and her children had slipped my mind. But they were safe as any Negroes in Tulsa could be, tucked away in a white neighborhood full of lawyers and bankers and merchants. It was Ruby I was scared for, knowing she might be out on the streets in the middle of a gunfight. And perhaps Mama heard something in my tone, or perhaps she understood me better than I knew, for she asked was I all right. Then a dark shape sped by outside, and when I gave her a hesitant yes, Mama asked was I sure. I eyed the Springfield on the counter, said, "I'm sure, Mama, don't you worry." Then I hung the earpiece up, set the telephone down, and grabbed my gun. Whatever was outside had been moving too fast to be a person and too slow to be an automobile. I crouched down and waited until a soft rapping came from the storeroom. Shotgun at my shoulder, I made sure the front door was locked. The rapping came louder. My feet moved against their better judgment. My throat seized up. My palms went clammy. But I kept walking until I got to the storeroom door, where I stopped and put my ear to the wood and heard it again. Knock, knock, knock. Knock, knock, knock. The storeroom was pitch black, save for a patch of moonlight shining through the high-set ventilation window on the back wall. Thankfully, all my afternoon's mopping had taught me where every last crate and stool in the place was, enough so I could get to the back door without so much as stubbing my toe. I leaned towards it, waiting for another knock. A kick. Something. Only what I heard was a grunt, then metal scraping overhead. Warm air blew across my cheek, and a deep voice came, hushed and desperate, but a relief to me nonetheless, calling out for the girl I hadn't been able to get off my mind all night. Ruby? Ruby, are you there? I found Joseph in the alley, standing atop a wobbly stack of crates from the stationer's next door. He got himself just high enough to catch hold of the back window's sill, but not high enough to see in. It was a precarious arrangement even without the surprise of me opening the door. The crates underneath him swayed and swung, then the stacked toppled like so many jackstraws. Joseph didn't fall. He hung there, fingertips hooked over the sill, whispering a blue streak of curses that surprised me more than seeing him there done in the first place. "That you, Will?" he asked when his curses had run their course. I replied it was, and that he'd better come inside quick before someone heard the ruckus he was making and decided to investigate. He let go of the sill, landing heavy on his feet. "Ouch!" he grunted, shaking out his ankles and rubbing his knee. "I bet," I said. Then we stood there, Joseph casting a wary eye towards my Springfield, neither one of us knowing quite what to do. He spoke first. "You gonna call the police?" "Why?" I replied. "You gonna rob us?" He sighed, said, "You know full well I'm not." Which I did. Far as I was concerned, Joseph had paid off all but the finance fee on the Model 14, and would have been perfectly within his rights to carry it home. But both of us knew he hadn't come about the Victrola, and both of us knew he couldn't go home. "You seen Ruby?" he asked. I told him I had, only much earlier that day. Then I said again how he'd best come inside. "Word of honor, you won't call the police," he said. I swore it. Even so, Joseph deliberated long enough that I got tired of waiting and told him he could stay or go as he pleased. But I wasn't saying another word about Ruby until we were safe inside with the door locked behind us. He sighed and followed me into the shop, and I bolted the door and told him to stay put while I went to fetch the old oil lamp and matches Pop kept on a shelf next to the cleaning supplies. Then I carried the lamp back to where he was and lit it and turned the wick low, praying no one would notice its glow from the alley behind. After that, Joseph and I sat down on the floor. By the look of him, he was even more scared than me. Yet he started right in talking, saying how Ruby had been missing since noon. As a rule, she never played hooky until the last hour of the school day. Noon was early enough that her teacher had telephoned their mother at the cafe to let her know. "Peach pies," I murmured. "What's that?" Joseph asked. So I told him how Ruby had been visiting me for the last 2 months, and how she'd said their mother was a baker who made wonderful peach pies. Joseph let out a sob disguised as a cough, and my own throat swelled up tight. But it didn't stop me from saying I was worried about Ruby, too, and that I wanted to help him find her. "You mean it?" he asked. I replied that I did, then pointed to the Springfield and said I knew how to use it. "Maybe so," he replied. "But would you do it on her behalf?" I thought about Ruby, and the carloads of armed men who'd driven past our house, and the marks on Maybelle for the Negroes Vernon Fish had shot. And there was no hesitation in my voice when I replied, "Yes, yes I would." That was the moment things began to change between me and Joseph. Not in any way I could define, more in a way I could feel. He told me what he'd seen that night, how he'd been too far away from the courthouse steps to hear everything that transpired, but that he knew enough men had come down from Greenwood to make the white folks assembled there nervous. "I didn't see who fired the first shot," he said. "But it turned everyone still as statues. Second one got them moving, and by the third, they were screaming how they'd chase all us Negroes out of Tulsa for good." He went quiet, then cleared his throat and began again. "They started moving up Boulder. I ran east along a side street. Plenty of those men from Greenwood are soldiers come back from the war. They know how to fight, but they weren't at the courthouse for that. Not most of them, leastways. They just wanted to make sure Dick Rowland lived long enough to stand trial. But now? Well, if a white man shoots at them first, they'll shoot back. Only do you know how many white men there are for every one of us, Will?" "Near 10, I replied. Joseph nodded. I asked him did he know any other places where Ruby might hide. He shook his head, saying, "I've checked all her usual haunts twice already, including here." Then it occurred to me that Joseph must have been worried about his mother on top of everything else. So I told him I'd seen her earlier that night. "She was afraid for you both," I said, "but she was safe." "How do you know where I live?" he asked. I replied I'd been helping our housekeeper's family, and one of her grandsons had told me the address. He frowned like he didn't quite believe me, but the space between us softened even more. Then I asked, did his family have a telephone? Joseph said no, but their neighbors, Mr. and Mrs. Tyler, did. Only, when I took him up to the store's counter to call, the Tylers didn't answer. Neither did anyone at the Nut and Honey Cafe, which Joseph said normally didn't close till midnight. I'm sure your ma's fine, I said, aiming to make him feel better. How do you figure that? Joseph replied. And the God's honest truth was that I had no idea if Mrs. Goodhope was fine or not, nor any reasonable basis for making assumptions either way. So I changed the subject, suggesting that if the crowd at the courthouse was moving north towards Greenwood from downtown, maybe we could take the truck out wide to the east, turn north, and come down into the area from above. You ride in the back of the truck so no one sees you, I said. With any luck, we'll get to your house and find out Ruby got home long ago. Joseph looked at me, his face more open and true than ever I'd seen it. Why would you do that? He asked. Which was a question I couldn't answer. Nor, as it turned out, did I have to. For just as I was about to mumble how I only wanted to help, headlamps lit up the shop window, passed by slow, and stopped. Joseph went still as a possum. Get down, I whispered, blowing out the lamp. Stay low, crawl back to the storeroom and wait for me there. When he didn't move, I said it again, loud enough to shock him into dropping to the floor. Then he made for the back, leaving me there with the Springfield clutch tight. Please go, I thought to myself, praying the automobile would move on. Seconds ticked by. Minutes. Enough of them so that I switched to whispering for Joseph to stay put in the back. For if he tried to sneak out through the alley, whoever had parked across the street was bound to see him. I patted my pocket and felt the fob ring holding the truck's keys. Then I slipped out from behind the counter and pressed my back against the north wall. Fast as I dared, I slid forward, keeping to the shadows all the way up to the front corner of the shop until a rap came at the glass so sharp my belly dropped clear to my boots. I looked down the length of the front windows and saw Cleet's profile. And past him, someone taller with his cap pulled low. Will? Cleet hollered, cupping his hands around his eyes to peer inside. I know you're in there, Will. I stepped away from the wall. Then Cleet saw me and I noticed the rifle at his chest. He smiled and motioned with one arm, shouting, Come on out, Will. We got some hunting to do. I resisted the urge to look back towards the storeroom and hollered through the glass how Pop had told me to stay put and guard the shop. We come to grant you a reprieve, Cleet bellowed. Besides, ain't nobody gonna mess with white men's property tonight. I can't leave, I replied. And Cleet elbowed the figure next to him and the two of them laughed. You let me in right now, Will Tillman, Cleet hollered, or I'll tell your pa you were too lily-livered to come out. I told you, I hollered back. Pop said to guard the shop. And Cleet looked straight at me with a predator cast to his eyes, saying, Who do you think sent me here in the first place? Then the man beside him moved out of the shadows and tipped back his cap. He held up a wicker fishing creel stuffed full to overflowing with bullets, shaking it so I could hear the clink of them through the glass. And he smiled around the cigar between his lips and pressed his horrible face close to the glass, saying, Open the door, half-breed. Or I'll smash it in myself.
Rowan. James showed up Tuesday night with gelato and a grin. Petty crime's my calling, he said, handing me a dish of half-melted coconut and chocolate. And by the way, that's très chic. He meant the hideous neck brace I'd finally given in and put on. Smart-ass banter didn't feel natural yet. But I played along anyway, hoping it would help get things back to normal. Good. That's what I was going for. Do you have the title? James lifted the strap of his messenger bag over his head. Of course. Because yours truly possesses one of the great criminal minds of the century. They just gave it to you, didn't they? He took a thick sheaf of papers out of the bag. Didn't even ask for ID. Now, it turned out that reading our house's title was only slightly easier than reading the clinic's insurance manual, but it was definitely more interesting. The first few documents were typed on paper as thin as an onion skin. They showed that the land our house was built on had been signed over to the Muscogee Creek Nation by President Millard Fillmore in 1852. There hadn't even been an Oklahoma then, only Indian Territory. After that, we read from the yellowed pages how the tribe had given my family's lot to a 17-year-old girl named America Manuel, who was listed as a freedman, a black slave who'd belonged to the Muscogee Creek Nation, but had been freed after the Civil War, which meant that the first person to own our property was a teenage girl with brown skin. I set the empty gelato cup aside and took the title from James's hand so I could see her name up close. That is so cool! He reached across me and flipped the page, no doubt. I don't think she ever lived here, though. She leased the land to a farmer first, then to the Anchor Oil Company. After she sold it in 1904, it changed hands. He took the title back and flipped pages quickly, counting under his breath. 8 times. But there's nothing about a house until... More flipping. Ha! What? I peeked over his shoulder. He pointed out 2 names at the top right corner of the page. Stanley G. Tillman and Catherine E. Tillman. No shit, I whispered. Yep. Stanley and Catherine bought the lot in 1920, and here's a construction mortgage in their names for $25,000. So apparently, they built the house too. Only, what? James kept reading. I'm not sure, but I think... Wait. Yeah. Here. Stanley and Catherine owned the land and built the house, but if they lived here, it wasn't for very long. See? He pointed to a tiny line of type. In November of 1922, my great-great-grandfather and great-great-grandmother, Flowers and Ora Chase, paid $29,000 cash for the house James and I were sitting in and the land underneath it. Which meant that since the Victrola receipt and the newest coin in the skeleton's pocket were from 1921, there was a good chance the body was in the back house before my great-greats ever moved in. Maybe there isn't a murderer in your family tree after all, James said. You relieved? I flipped the title closed and rolled my eyes, saying, oh, so very. And you know, I actually kind of was. William Tillman's parents built this house. He left home sometime before the Polk Huffine directory came out in 1922. No one could find him when his father died, and he almost definitely would have had access to the back house while it was under construction. Bottom line, there was a good chance he was either the skeleton or the guy who'd put it there. Only, the more James and I talked things through, the less likely it seemed that the body could be William's. For one thing, we didn't see how he could have been black. Yes, uncomfortable as it made me, I was willing to give Geneva's race theory the benefit of the doubt. His father, Stanley, must have been white. Otherwise, Tulsa's Jim Crow laws would have made it impossible for him to own any business on Main Street other than a shoeshine box. And when we tracked down the Tillman family tree on Ancestry, William's mother turned out to have been one of the original 2,228 Osage Indian tribe members given a headright allotment and 160 homestead acres in 1906. That meant she'd had money, because the Osage had made sure the mineral rights for tribal land, translation, the oil rights, stayed communal. And that meant all the profits from oil pumped out of Osage land went into one big account, and 4 times a year, everyone with a headright got a check for an equal percentage share. Now I get how they could have afforded this house, James said. I thought it was pretty fancy for a guy who sold record players. I took my computer from him and ignored how the glow from the screen made my eyes ache. It could explain more than just the money, I said. Those headrights were valuable. Maybe William tried to claim his mother's after she died. If he did, we might be able to track him down through tribal records. James spotted something on the page I was looking at. Can I see that for a sec? He asked. I handed him the laptop. Okay, I thought I remembered this, he said. A bunch of Osage, especially Osage women, were murdered in the 1920s after the government decided that anyone who was half Indian or more needed a white guardian to manage their money. Lovely, I said. James sighed. I know, right? So anyway, a lot of white men married Osage women just to get control of their fortunes. Then a bunch of those women started dying in weird ways. Drowning in shallow creeks, falling out of third-story windows, turning up with bullet holes in their skulls. No one really looked into the deaths until the FBI finally stepped in. After the white guardians had inherited the women's money and head rights, that is. Figures, I said. But what does it have to do with the skeleton? Well, I know your anthropologist friend said it's from a black man. But what if she's wrong? The DNA tests haven't come back yet, have they? Maybe she isn't as great as she thinks at telling Native American skulls apart from African American ones. Or it could be that she's just completely full of crap about being able to judge someone's skin color by their skulls in the first place. I shrugged. That doesn't change my question. What does any of that have to do with our skeleton? Well, I was thinking that maybe, just maybe, Stanley Tillman was a cold-blooded bastard and killed his own son to keep him from inheriting Catherine's money and headright. That doesn't make sense, I said. We know Catherine didn't die until 1976, way after Stanley. If he was willing to kill his own son to get her money, wouldn't he have killed her too? James clicked back to the family tree. This says that Catherine Yellowhorse Tillman died in 1976 in Pawhuska, not Tulsa. And she was there when Stanley died in 1937. That's more than an hour north of here. What's to say old Stanley didn't knock off William, let his wife go out of her mind worrying about her missing son, then ship her off to relatives up north while he stayed here in town? He was in charge of her money anyway. Maybe once the son was out of the way, it didn't matter to him if Catherine was alive or dead. I closed the computer. Don't you think your theory might be just a tiny bit influenced by the messed up father-son dynamic in your house? Maybe, he said. But maybe Stanley was a racist prick and didn't want a half-Indian son to begin with. I shoved the computer to the foot of the bed with my toes. I guess it's possible, James. But I'm too tired to deal with thinking about that right now. He gave me a guilty look. You're supposed to be resting. I know. But you could be onto something with the Osage connection. Yeah? Yeah. Catherine didn't die until 1976. So there's a good chance somebody in Pawhuska remembers her. You're right, James said. In fact, he opened my laptop back up and typed something into the search bar, clicked a few times, and scrolled. Look. He spun the screen toward me, and there on the Osage Tribal Museum website was Catherine Yellowhorse Tillman, staring out from 1898, where she'd been waiting for us all along. I dreamed of Catherine Yellowhorse that night. That's how I thought of her. Because Tillman didn't fit the girl in the picture. Not the black shine of her hair, or the open kindness of her face, or the way her smile played out in her eyes more than her lips. And even though she may never have lived in our house, it's where I pictured her, gliding through the halls in a white flapper dress and pearls. When my phone went off just after 8 the next morning, I was in the dream myself, doing the Charleston at a party in the Philcade building downtown that would have made Jay Gatsby jealous. I squinted at the unfamiliar number on the screen. Hello? Ms. Chase? I sat up. My neck was still stiff, but it was better. Yes? Ms. Chase, this is Michael Mercury from News Hacker Media. I was wondering if you could share your insights into Arvin Brightwater's death? And maybe you'd like to let our readers know how you're doing, too. What? You're Rowan Chase, right? Yes, but I swung my legs over the edge of the bed. The 17-year-old driver involved in the car accident that occurred prior to Arvin Brightwater's death. I stood up wide awake. How did you get my number? I can't tell you my source, he said. But if you'll just... No, I won't just... I hung up and sank onto the window seat. With the morning sun glinting off the back house windows, the only thing I saw in them was the reflection of a red bud tree. I blocked the number that had just called, then searched Arvin Brightwater. The first hit, a CNN story about candlelight prayer vigils scheduled across the country for that night, was a surprise. I didn't know anyone outside Tulsa had even heard about Arvin's death. At the same time, it was good. I liked the idea of people holding flames up against the dark in Arvin's honor. And if that had been all I'd found, maybe I could have let things go. But it wasn't. And I couldn't. Pages and pages of hits came back. Jerry Randall was a racist, and pushing Arvin in front of the car was a hate crime. Jerry Randall was the victim and had been defending himself against a crazy homeless man. The mental health system had let Arvin fall through the cracks. It was the teenage driver's fault for causing the accident that led to the confrontation. If the police didn't go after Randall, Tulsa would be Ferguson all over again, and on and on and on. Nearly every single person who wrote about Arvin in articles, tweets, and comment sections acted like they knew what happened. They got it. They were appropriately sad or angry or confused or forgiving or whatever. They understood. Which was funny, because I'd been there, and I was mixed up as hell. Angry, too, that no one had told me Arvin's story was blowing up. Mom and Dad, True, James, they'd all kept it secret, as if I was too fragile to handle reality. The more I thought about it, the more I realized that reality was exactly what I'd needed all along. It would have helped to know that people were talking about Arvin, remembering him. It mattered. It made his death matter. And it was exactly the kind of thing I had to know if I was going to make sense of what had happened. I took Geneva's business card down from the bulletin board over my window seat and ran my finger over the lettering next to the 5-pointed Oklahoma star. It wasn't even in purple Sharpie like the medical examiner sign in her van. Geneva was odd, but she'd been straight with me from the start and had never treated me like a child. Maybe she'd learned more about the skeleton or had ideas of her own about who he'd been. Maybe she didn't. Either way, it couldn't hurt to find out.
William. Vernon turned on the overhead lights and lit up a Robusto as soon as I let him inside the shop. He handed one to Cleet, too, and Cleet near burst from pride as Vernon lit it for him. Then Cleet sucked in a big lung full of smoke that turned him green as springtime in the light from Mama's Chinese lanterns. Vernon cackled and smacked his back, saying, "Ain't supposed to inhale, son." Then he offered one to me. I declined, and Vernon shrugged, said, "Here's the story. Me and my friends have been deputized special to help shut down this Negro uprising we got going on. And as a duly sworn officer of the law, I'm enlisting your help." I must have looked as dubious as I felt, for Cleet said, "It's true, Will. Some old coon down at the courthouse wouldn't hand over his pistol when a white deputy told him to. Next thing you know, there's guns firing and 7 kinds of hell breaking loose, and all because those Greenwood boys don't know their place." Vernon grunted, then started in like General Pershing himself, talking about skirmish lines and battle plans and how the Negroes had made their stand just south of 3rd Street. "Turns out, some of them fought in the war and picked up a thing or two about combat," he said. "We aimed to show them they'd have been better off learning to duck." At that, he took Maybell out of the holster on his belt and carved 2 more notches into her with his pocket knife. Cleek grinned and looked back and forth between me and Vernon, asking did I know what the notches meant. "He knows," Vernon said, squinting against the wavering column of smoke from his cigar. Then he blew the filings off of Maybell, said, "Now that we got the ammo we came for, the three of us best get moving. We got a long night ahead of us." Only I didn't want to go anywhere with Vernon and Cleet and their guns. So I said again how Pop had told me to guard the store, and Cleet insisted Pop had sent them to get me. "He truly said that?" I asked Cleet direct. "He said for you to fetch me." Cleet's eyebrows furrowed. "Well, he didn't get a chance to come right out and say for us to fetch you," he said. "But that's only because we got separated once the fighting heated up." Which told me straight off that Pop hadn't said any such thing, and that I'd been suckered into opening the shop door in the first place. Though, of course, there would have been hell to pay if I hadn't. After that, Cleet yammered on about war and duty and white men needing to stand up for what was theirs. Vernon's dead eyes stayed on me until Cleet finally shut up. Then Vernon said, "Listen to me, and listen close, half-breed. There's good niggers and bad ones. Good ones know their place. Bad ones don't. What's happening here tonight is an old-fashioned purge. We're gonna flush the bad ones out of Tulsa once and for all." I gave no response, for there was nothing I could think to say. Then Vernon pushed his face so close to mine that I felt the heat from the tip of his cigar against my cheek. "I'll brook no cowardice, boy," he said. "Now you quit pissing and moaning like a damned woman and come fight." I thought of Joseph and Ruby then, and Angelina and her grandbabies, and knew in my heart what I believed. "No, sir, Mr. Fish," I said softly. "I can't do that." Cleet was silent beside me. Vernon's face went white with fury. He walked to the demo machine Pop and I used to play music for customers and, casual as could be, pushed it over. Wood splintered. Metal twisted. "Let's try that again," Vernon said. "You're gonna come with us right now, or so help me God, I'll destroy every last thing in this place and tell your pa you weren't man enough to protect it from rioters. Cleet here'll back me up, won't you?" Cleet focused on his boots, but mumbled a yes quick enough. And though the thought of Vernon ruining the shop was none too pleasant, it was my fear of what he'd do if he found Joseph in the back room that tipped the scales on my decision once and for all. "All right, Mr. Fish," I said. "I'll come." "Good," Vernon muttered. Then he spun me about by the shoulders and shoved me out the door. I stopped on the sidewalk saying I had to lock up. And I went slow as I could, leaning my Springfield against the door, dropping the keys, pretending the bolt was stubborn. So that by the time I looked up and across the street, Cleet had got behind the wheel of his daddy's Cadillac and Vernon was climbing into the seat beside him. Their cigars glowed red in the hot night air. And though darkness cloaked Vernon's features, I could still picture the smile on his face. The one saying he'd won, and I was nothing but a stupid boy. Shots sounded to the north. So many I lost count. Then silence. Until Vernon Fish broke it. "Let's go, half-breed," he cried. "The night's young and we've got killing to do." The Cadillac's engine growled to life. My pulse quickened. And without letting myself overthink the matter, I loosed a curse loud and vivid enough to make Vernon and Cleet spin around, mouths open in surprise. "Forgot my shotgun shells," I hollered. And before either one of them could say a word to stop me, I was through the door I hadn't locked in the first place. "Joseph!" I yelled, running to the storeroom. But there was no sign of him there. My heart sank, worrying he'd gone out through the back. I called his name again as I swapped the door keys in my hand for the truck key in my pocket. And just as I was about to go look for Joseph in the alley, I heard my name from the darkest corner of the room. There being no time to chat, I shouted for him to follow me to the truck. Then the two of us were outside in the warm night air, running on the balls of our feet to keep our heels from clipping the concrete. I got in my side and jammed the key into the ignition, praying the engine would catch easy. And for once the heavens listened, so that as soon as Joseph had got beside me with the passenger door shut, I hit the reverse pedal and dropped the throttle level hard. The truck bucked and squealed on a main street like an unbroke horse. I swung its nose north, went to neutral, stomped the clutch, promptly felt the engine go dead. There we were, ass backwards to Vernon and Cleet, motor stalled, Cleet shouting, Vernon sputtering, the Cadillac's engine revving. I stepped on the starter.